This is an RNZ podcast.
No mai whakarongo mai ki te aotai whenua. Welcome to Country Life. I'm Sally Round.
And I'm Duncan Smith. G'day. Today we hear how a farmer in the Wairau Valley had to swim his sheep to safety after the big rains this week. That's in our look at conditions on the land coming up shortly.
Susan Murray's kidding around with a very positive dairy goat farmer. And later I head to Clifton Station in Hawke's Bay to meet another farmer with a literary bent.
But first, our guest this week is Stuart Weston, the chief executive of the kiwi fruit grower and packhouse owner Apata. The company is on the hunt for land around Whanganui.
So we've been associated with a very small contingent of green growers in the Whanganui area for probably two decades now. And a few years ago, one of my growers challenged me about what were we doing down in the Whanganui region. We've been working on this for quite some time, and there's rubber has been hitting the road in recent times. Order of magnitude, out of 13,000 hectares in the kiwifruit industry that's growing kiwifruit, Whanganui is about 70, so it's about 0.5% of the entire region. But having been associated with that region for quite some time, we're quite enamoured of the region, and particularly its people. So there's some really great... Whanganui is a pretty special place for a number of reasons. One is the soil types down there. You've got some beautiful Egmont black loams, free-draining volcanic soils. You've got plentiful water supply. There's quite a complementary seasonal labour peak with the associated freezing works down there. And just a fun fact, Whanganui is actually the birthplace of New Zealand kiwifruit. That's where the whole story started out. What we are finding in the Bay of Plenty is we're running out of land, good land to develop, and starting to push into some more marginal areas. Yet the whole time we've had this long association with Whanganui, and as we've looked closer at it, talked with our existing partners down there, and taking a spade down and had a look underground, we've been very impressed with what we've seen. So that's why we're interested in the region. So out of that existing 70 hectares that's grown down there, we've already developed a further 60. And the order of magnitude that we're thinking in that region would sort of be around about a further 200 hectares that we think would be a very nice critical mass size to warrant to support management and infrastructure down there to make it a really viable industry. Look, there's no magical number, and it's really depending on who we partner with and the quality of the land, its suitability for horticulture. So what we've found with the region is, despite there being a lot of excellent, perfectly suited land to horticulture, the land is fairly tightly held by existing landowners there, and so experience coming down there has been when we've come across land that has been suitable for it, when the owners have been asking, well, what do you plan to do with it? Once we've told them and shown them the numbers, they've tended to stay involved in it and vend in their own land or actually do it themselves with our help. So, and we're agnostic either way. That doesn't really concern us. We do have a lot of investors who are looking to invest in orchard developments. However, the form it's taken in Whanganui up until now, it's actually been the locals that have retained the ownership of it, and we've just continued to partner with the locals down there.
Where will the fruit be packed, and how many, if you get 200 hectares plus the existing stuff, how many trays would you be looking at?
So we're looking at a region that would be producing between 2 and 3 million trays, principally of the green kiwi fruit. We're open to the looking at the red variety as well, which is also coming on. But the idea is that it would be consolidated through our Bay of Plenty based processing facility.
And as you say, sort of be mainly green, but you might look at the red. Not looking at gold?
No, well, the gold's a great product, but the Bay of Plenty is now gripped by gold fever, such that the entry price to that is really getting well past the common man, challenging the economics of it. What our kiwifruit industry has been forgetting is the value of the green product. So we've seen quite an attrition over the last 10 years. You know, that's partly the fact that some Bay of Plenty growers have been converting some green over to gold, but we've also been gobbling up a lot of very good horticultural land with real estate developments as well. So we're seeing a continued attrition there. Yet the green proposition is extremely strong. It's quite different to that of gold. So gold is a very sexy, great-tasting fruit, looks nice, tastes nice, grows well. It's great. But it's very high entry cost to get into that now. The green is, if you think of green more as a food, as a medicine, so it's a great taste. And nutritionally, it's one among the most nutritionally dense whole fruit products you can eat. Therefore, we see opportunity to invest back in that category.
Stuart Weston, the Chief Executive of Upeta, talking to Susan Murray.
You're listening to Country Life on RNZ National, 101 FM.
And now to our look around the Motu. Northland's had lots of rain. Typically winter's wet in the north, but it's missed out in the past 2 years, so it seems things are back to normal. Grass growth is slow and there are lots more cattle coming to market than usual. Farmers want their excess animals off the wet pastures. Northland's dairy farmers are in the thick of calving. Pukekohe has had rain or showers every day. 50 millimetres has fallen and vegetable paddocks are wet and muddy. For growers with winter veggies to harvest, wet weather clothing has been essential.
A Waikato farmer says calving's running really smoothly. He's 8 days in and already 35% of his calves have arrived. He says the payout's good, he's delighted with his new 220-cow herd and thinks he should find something to complain about but can't. The only thing causing a little concern is that pasture covers are pegging down a bit. Bay of Plenty dairy farmers are in a good spot too. They were working under sunny skies on Friday, calving's going well and there are decent feed levels.
A farmer in northern King Country grabbed his glasses and went out to read the rain gauge when we rang. He's recorded 150 millimetres for the week. Heifers have started calving on dairy farms and the bulk of the early lambs will start appearing in about 10 days' time. On average, pregnancy scanning of mixed-age ewes has come in at just shy of 170%. Taranaki's had a wet, wild and windy week. Storms last weekend resulted in power outages and quite a bit of wind damage. Heavy rain near Stratford has put 200 millimetres in the gauge for the week. Further up the mountain at Dawson Falls, they've had 950 and flooding of rivers and creeks. The rains washed the snow off Mount Taranaki's ski field.
In the Gisborne area, early lambs are starting to pop out on the front country. Farmers are feeling lucky, as it's been nicely wet and then turned warm, which is perfect for growth. The last of the region's mandarins are coming off the trees, and growers are deep into the navel orange harvest. Returns for navels are as good as they've been in a long time. It's a supply and demand thing. With poor prices, lots of trees were ripped out and have been replaced by apples and kiwi fruit, so there is not as many about. And shipping disruptions with COVID have been a boom for New Zealand growers. It's difficult to get oranges in from Australia. Supermarkets are often full of Australian oranges at this time of year because it's cheaper to buy them and ship them than it is to get them from New Zealand orchards. Hawke's Bay hasn't had the heavy rain that's been seen elsewhere, and in fact is still reasonably dry. Farms are in good shape. They're getting little regular rains and need that to continue in order to cope with summer. Grass is still growing because it's been dry and warm.
July in the Taihape region has brought a really hard run of frosts, which has been followed up with warm northerly rain. It was desperately needed and things have greened up a little. Soil temperatures are limiting growth though, and everyone's pretty tight for feed. Ewe scanning's underway as well as winter shearing, where there are dry sheep. For the first time, farmers are having to apply for consent to be able to crop their land. They've received the paperwork and we're told it's daunting. The Wairarapa feed situation is short, but paddocks are green and growing. Stock are in good nick, and there are early lambs on the flats. There's been enough rain to fill dams and get creeks running. Farmers are very pleased that the days are getting longer, and sometimes the sun even comes out.
The Nelson-Tasman region also copped heavy rain last weekend, with numerous places flooding. Land around Murchison and north towards Tupperwera. Hop, apple and kiwifruit orchards on lower land were inundated. It was the biggest flood since 1926. Federated farmers and others are just assessing what help is needed. Extra hands are already on some properties, fixing fences and getting debris out of wires and structures on horticultural blocks. Elsewhere, the ground is just sodden. In the Marlborough region, large parts of the Wairo Valley went underwater and silt is still heavily coating some vineyards. Towards Lower Wairo on the coast, a lot of lambs died because they were grazing in vineyards that flooded. Within days, the water was generally draining away, and for most of the region, damage was minimal. Marlborough grape grower cooperative viticulturalist Johnny McMillan says the district council's flood containment scheme worked incredibly well under extreme pressure, and without it, damage from the floodwater would have been hard to comprehend. One farmer west of Wairo village, who had to swim sheep to safety and had hundreds of vineyard posts damaged, spent the week starting the clean-up. He thinks it'll cost him $20,000 for new fence posts and doing the repairs, and he sold the sheep. One plus, he says, is there should be no issue with aquifer levels this summer.
On the west coast, about 30 farms suffered damage in the Buller area. 10 were very hard hit. Silt's covering some paddocks and fences, but repairs got underway as the week progressed. Karamea farms also went underwater, but not nearly as badly. Feed supplies will be tight and some farmers will probably need to buy more in. Meanwhile, further south on the coast, it was more of an ordinary wet week. Despite the red warnings, huge volumes of rain didn't arrive. Pastures are growing because the rains kept frosts away, but it's too wet for comfort. Dairy calves are arriving on farms around Fox and Wataroa. It was another wet week in Canterbury, with some flooding again at the start of the week. Unfortunately, there's been some additional damage in places, and farmers who just completed repairs found that work all undone again. Winter grazing's coming to an end, with cows heading home over the next couple of weeks. Tractor work is non-existent at the moment with the wet conditions. When things do dry out, there'll be a lot to do.
Central Otago is wet and mucky, but grass is starting to grow again, and in the past week, ice on the Eider Dam has entirely gone. Willow trees are red, which means they're in bud, and that's jolly early. Farmers are desperately trying to get shearing done before scanning. It's really difficult between frequent showers of rain. Lambing in the hills is still 2 months away. One farmer, who held on to some crossbred wool for a year because he wasn't going to give it away, sold it this week. He said prices have lifted a little, which is pleasing, and he thinks that could continue. South Otago is having a real winter. There's been good rainfall and ground moisture is okay. It's shaping up so far for a good start to spring, which, apparently, with the flick of a switch, could start in another 10 days. Our contact's first lambs arrived on Thursday, a tad earlier than expected. He says farmers should be able to manage winter crop feeding well this season, and utilisation is excellent. Air temperatures are around 10 degrees, so pastures are lifting. He says he's happy after the toughest 12 to 15 months ever, with droughts and 2 floods.
Southland had a damp start to the week and then fine frosty weather followed. We're told it's been a fairly easy winter for animals this year, and they've come through well. Calving's yet to start in earnest. Some farmers are still looking for labour. With people thinner on the ground, everyone else is having to work longer hours, as the jobs still need to be done. Anyone looking for homes in rural Southland towns has to be quick. Demand is high.
Now Susan Murray's off to meet a farmer on the outskirts of Hamilton who takes great pride in how his place looks. But he says it's because he wants it that way, not because of anything he's been told he must do.
Is a dairy goat farm. It's kidding time.
So 1st of July is the start of kidding, and it will carry on for 6 weeks at least. Yeah, the first 6 weeks is what I call orchestrated chaos.
And this is dairy goat farmer James Hill.
So we planted all our trees, everything you can see.
Yeah, nothing was here when you came?
Absolutely nothing, not even a fence. And those ones are 5 years old now. Look at how beautiful they are already. And honestly, that makes such a difference to my well-being and that of the farm. Plus, when you come into the farm and you see all these trees, it tells you the place is alive. Something is happening here, you see. And that's important, because otherwise, it's like going to work and feeling sulking all day. You want to be enthusiastic. You want to be enjoying life. You can see there our sign there. It's only the best for our goats. That's what we do every single day. What you do when you wake up is do the best for your goats, and they will look after you. It's simple. Life is actually very simple. We make it way too complicated. But yeah, that's just my opinion.
Does Jubal 5 mean anything?
That was also on the sign with only the best for our goats.
Yes, this is the fifth farm me and my dad bought since we've started farming 30 years ago. Yep. This is our fifth farm and the last farm we buy. We will not buy anymore, but so that, and Jubal itself means rejoice. That's what the word means. In Afrikaans, it means rejoice. So if you come to this farm and you do not rejoice, please do not come here, because this is what we do on this farm. We enjoy what we're doing. This is our life.
A new life that started when he left South Africa in 2005. He, his father and daughter Danielle were looking for a better life, away from politics and violence. And during the plane trip, he went from boss to boy. The 1,150-hectare sheep, beef and maize farm he owned turned into working for a number of years on a couple of dairy goat farms. A valuable and learning time, he says. He then purchased this 30 hectares, which, along with 8 hectares of lease land, is enough to run a profitable dairy goat unit. He milks 450 does.
So all the doe kids, most of them I sell, but apart from the replacements I keep. And then all the buck kids, most of them will go for what we call cabrito kids. Don't know if you've heard about that. Oh, it's Tukuiti meats. They buy all, we rear them to 10 kilograms, and then then they sell them off all over the world, actually. It's a delicacy. Can you believe that? But they were only allowed milk and hay, because they want the meat white. So that's what we do with the buck kids.
How long does it take to get them to 10 kgs?
Oh, about 3 weeks. Okay. 3 weeks, almost 4 weeks, depending on what you use. Like this season, because we have such a big stockpile of milk powder at the co-op, we're using real milk, so it will be quicker. Otherwise, we buy what Fonterra sells us, the Ann lamb or whatever, and that takes a bit longer. And we are 100% all the buckets go to them. So we don't dong them like we used in the old days. That doesn't happen no more. Makes you feel better that at least it's not wasted and so forth, you know, which makes sense.
And these ones, they're Saanens, are they?
Yeah, predominantly Saanen. I've got a bit of Toggenburg as well.
How long do they stay in the flock?
I've got ones that are here already 10 years. Normally, the ratio will probably be about 7 to 8 years max, but I've got ones that just keep going, and they are like pet goats now. They don't produce as well as they used to. I think year 3 and 4 is their best. Yeah, you need to get a balance between production and longevity, because it costs a lot of money to rear them. You know, it's over $500+ to rear one kid. And if you have to replace a heck of a lot every year.
$500?
Yeah, easy.
To rear one kid?
Yeah.
Why so expensive?
Oh, it's just the milk powder that you use and obviously labour and all of that. But yeah.
Okay. And what do you like about goats?
Their personality is awesome. They are individuals like us. They are absolutely, some are naughty, some are good, some are plain evil. You get everything here. And they're easy controllable. They talk to you, you know. If you're late with milking or something, they moan. They tell you there's not, you're late, or whatever the case is. So it's just such awesome animals. They're more like pets than animals. But, yeah, that's what I love about them. And obviously, the financial aspect of the goats is a lot more profitable than cows or anything else. That's why we chose to get into goat farming and not cow farming. Because you can actually, with a small piece of land, have a good life.
Right. Yep. Yeah, because the milk's going really well.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, now we've got joint trauma. We are struggling a bit as a co-op at the moment with because of COVID. We lost a bit of our market just because of logistics and so forth. But that will come right. All our milk powder are put into infant formula, and that's being sold over, I think, 20-plus countries all across the world. And we're probably the best of the best when it comes to quality. So we 90% grass-fed. You know, we don't buy in stuff like in Europe and all those places. They just buy in all their feed them every day, where we are all grass. And that you can't be more natural than that.
And that's what you call it's cut and carry, isn't
yeah,
it? Because
cut and
you
carry.
Actually you house them. We're in an open-sided barn.
Yeah.
Well, protected down the sides, but a barn.
Yes.
So they're always inside or
yes.
Undercover.
Yeah, but, yeah. There is times that they go out, especially the young ones. They've got a play area where they go out and play because that first year, that's all they want to do, and they enjoy it so much. But the older does don't care that much. They love to be inside. And the other big reason for being inside is the parasites. You know, if you have them outside, there is a few dairy goat farms that are outdoors. They do struggle a bit with the parasites. That's the big reason why we went indoors. And then they don't want to get wet. They hate water. That's just one thing about goats. They do not like being wet. Yeah. So it's just unbelievable. We are so blessed here with the grass we have. There's nowhere in the world I've seen grass grow like here in New Zealand. And that's our competitive advantage. And I think sometimes farmers forget that. That is our competitive advantage, is the grass. That's where we beat everyone in the world. Just walk over there. I want to show you my breeding mops, which are the best ones. That
Gee.
Mama just had four.
Four?
Yeah, four.
How often do they have four?
Oh, it just happens. They always have twins or more. Where's Mikey? Come, Mikey. Come here. Hey, wake up. Now, I call her Mikey, which means, if you translate it, my pet, my friend. Yeah, so in Afrikaans, it's Mikey. Hey, come, Mikey. Come, miso papa. Oh, she's having a sleep now. She'll come over later when we milk. And my daughter Danielle, she's just helped those that doe there have those twins there. That one just kidded over there.
So that's their first standing up, is it? Yep.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, inside a minute, eh? It's unbelievable, eh? Nature is so wonderful.
They pop them out. Can they count? Do they know that they've had how many they've had?
No, but they do. They do go on the sound and the noise they're making after smell. So, yeah, no, they know exactly who's who.
And how's it going?
Good. Very busy, though.
Yeah. What do you enjoy?
Everything. Especially the little kids.
And you rear them to start with or all the right through? No.
They stay with mum's for 3 days and get colostrum. And after that, they come down to me. And then from there, they get hand-reared onto these red teats.
And then they self-feed after that?
Yep. Yep,
automatic feeder, yep.
Mm-hmm. Lovely, and it's just the two of you mainly doing it?
Yeah, and Dad.
He's busy picking up grass.
Yeah, he's just picking up grass at the moment. He'll be back any minute. And then I have my partner, she's rearing the cabritos over there in the implement shed.
And have you just learnt on the job?
Yeah, I've been learning since I was about 9. And ever since then, I've been milking goats as long as I can remember. so it's second nature. Mm-hmm.
And a career you'll stick with?
Yep, for sure. Now, once I finish uni, I'm in my last year now, and then I'll come with Dad full-time. I'm already full-time, but then I'll be officially finished with uni and all my studies.
What have you been studying?
I'm doing a bachelor in business, so I major in economics, and I minor in finance and agribusiness at Waikato.
And how surprised are other students that you've already in the business world?
Very surprised. Most of them are part-time working somewhere, doing restaurant work or anything like that. But for me, it's much easier because I'm already set up to where I want to go. For them, it can be hard to climb into the industry, especially agriculture.
So any tips for them?
Work hard. Work hard, stay focused, put the hours in. Even if you can't sleep at night, just make sure you get it done. You can't slack off or else you won't be able to make it.
Okay.
You want to see the cabritos?
Yeah.
Yep. Very surprising about the goats is that about 7 o'clock at night, they will stop. If anything starts trying to kid after that, there's something wrong normally. So I know that, and I just go and help and get it done. But normally, at 7 o'clock, they stop kidding, and then in the morning about 5 o'clock, they will start again. They take a break, which I enjoy.
It's very polite of them.
Yeah, very. Absolutely.
Maybe it's a bit like alpaca and it's sort of temperature related.
Must be. Yeah, I don't know the science behind it, but yes, that's what I think. So these are mostly all the bucks. And they, like I said, only milk and hay, that's all they're allowed. And they're just having the time of their lives. You can see your Holly put her whole play area. So that's the next stage where they're going to come to. Then they're going to come into here. So then they're going to have all their slides and whatever you can think of. It's here.
Slides and reels and tables to jump on.
Yep.
We try and give them the best that they can while they're here because they're not with us very long. So we give them everything that they could
want.
Yeah.
So it includes a lovely play area with lots of sawdust and,
So she's going to rear 700 plus. So they're going to have a very busy time for the next 2 months, pretty much. And then I can put my trackers back in here where I belong.
Hey! Hey, and your sheds are quite special because on the roof you've got your solar panels.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so what led to that? What's...
Well, we've had solar pumps in South Africa. So I had a bit of experience with it and it worked very well. So when I came here, Googled, got onto a Light Force and a few other companies. I had quotes from probably 4 or 5 different companies before I decided on Light Force. But yeah, just looking at the figures, it was actually a very simple decision to be made. It's just you make money in the process. There's no two ways about it, specifically because we use so much power in daytime. I would not advise it for households. I don't think you get ever your money back. Even with batteries, it's just too expensive still. There is going to be a time when it's actually going to be beneficial to do it for households. But for us, like, we've got all this roof space. And then because we use it in daytime when you actually pay a lot for your power, it's a no-brainer. Then you make your money on it. And it's good. It's I'm helping. I'm doing my bit for the country.
And so, and what are you doing for your pocket? Like, what sort of savings do you have? Because
it cost me, I think it was just over 70 grand to put in. And my first year, I got a return of 15%, which I think is awesome.
What would you say spent on electricity power in a month, and what would you spend now?
Well, it used to be about $1,500 a month. That's the dairy and the house. And I will now average about $400 a month instead of $1,500, which is a huge, huge saving. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you can feed some of that back to the grid?
Yes. Everything that's excess at the moment is just exported to the grid. You do not get paid much. In the beginning, we were paid 14 cents a kilowatt hour. We're only getting 7 cents a kilowatt hour now. But it makes a difference, especially in summertime. We're actually getting paid and not pay anything at all because just of the amount of export we have. That's what you want, isn't it? Look at that udder. You haven't. That is utter beauty. Look at that long body. He's just awesome. If I had 1,000 of them, I'd be a rich man.
That goat just has eyes for my dad, honestly. That goat's all about that. Yeah. Yeah, I'll show you the dairy. Yeah. And there's Pockle, a farm cat.
You seem to have a lot of cats.
Yeah, and they're all farm cats. But that was the first one that came. And again, my heart's too little to not feed them, so there's more now. I'll take you this one.
James Hill and his daughter Danielle.
What I find exciting about agriculture is it's a good career choice. You're always learning. You can always progress. There's always the next step. There's plenty of support out there, so you should try it as a job.
Country Life, 101 FM.
Hawke's Bay's long-established Clifton Station made its early fortunes off the sheep's back. But with wool prices down in the dumps, diversification has been the key to its survival in the 21st century. And as I found out on a recent trip to Clifton, the Gordons who work the land here have a few strings to their bow.
Right, everyone, this is Sally.
Morning.
A few days a week, a group of teens come to Clifton for hands-on farming experience.
We've got McCallum, what, and Kaz, The rangatahi are on the Turanga Araro farm training program set up by Gisborne Iwi. They're sheep handling today. Bruce Lecane is their tutor.
Dig some of the lambs here, up the ewe lambs, because they've got dags on them, and so we'll go through and sort them out, and Tom will dag them, and these are going to go through and be weighed through on the scales, so that's what we're here to do today.
What about the boys? What will they be doing?
Oh, they'll be tracing the stock and catching the sheep and operating the weighing machine, so we teach them how to do all that, yeah.
Do we not dig, Bruce?
Huh? Well, you can dag if you want to. Yeah.
It's the trade lambs that are being dagged today, but also in the yards are a new breed of sheep.
We've sort of bought into this whole idea of shedding sheep and getting away from shearing.
Tom Gordon works the farm in partnership with his father Angus, and they're building up a flock of self-shedding Wiltshires.
So this is our first crop of ewe lambs that we've bred. They've been out with the ram and... Yeah, we're just getting them in now to have a weigh up to see how they're doing. But we hope to build the flock up to about 1,500 ewes eventually. We're also doing the finishing lambs, so the lambs we've got over there that are just Romney Cross trade lambs. So we're doing sort of a couple of thousand of those over the winter as well. So that's what we're going to be dagging this morning.
Holy heckabroosh! Are they looking, Sam, but dirty?
Real dirty.
So Sam's just got a battery-powered... handpiece there, handy piece, and he can just operate with a little switch. And what we're doing, just we've got these Romneys in, and we're just giving them a bit of a touch up and then run them through the weigh scales, and the boys are able to do all of that, all the thing. They've just mustered these Wiltshires up themselves. No dogs, just lots of running around on the hills.
They run around like the dogs, don't you? Sam over there loves it. He takes off and he's faster than our dogs sometimes. He goes tearing
down
the
cliff. He's been up and down about four times, I think. Up and down the ridge, didn't you, Sam, to get five times?
Make sure you get right under those tails there, Sam. Yeah.
So is this your first generation of the Wiltshires?
We've got about 600 now, and so there's about 130-odd ewe lambs here. So this is our first generation of our homebred ones.
So you've got your own breeding program going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, yeah. So we're using Wiltshire rams, you can see over there, and then the ones that are a bit whiter... come from this new breed called Australian Whites, which a guy up in Mangakino has brought in, Kahu Genetics, and so they're called Kahu Whites, and they're just bringing a bit of genetic diversity into the Wiltshire breed.
And also to try and build up the fertility, because they're all very fertile with that hybrid vigour, and they're very fertile, so they're all those rams are twins out of twins out of twins.
Dad's not too keen to go too big, just because we get caught out with droughts.
Well, we quite enjoy doing this lamb trading as well. It gives us a lot of versatility, because we grow, Tom's got a lot of crops he's growing now. We're growing, 21 hectares of Rathno this year,
brassicas
and things, so we're fattening all these lambs on them. So we can
do about 30 hectares of oats down there too, which we're finishing lambs on as well. So
in the old days, we used to run... big numbers of cattle, capital stock. I'm talking back in the 70s and 80s. So, for example, we had 3,500 ewes here and 1,000 replacements and 400 cows and 150 replacements, and we were pouring on hundreds of tonnes of fertiliser every year, but it didn't make any difference if it didn't rain. And then in the 80s we had three debilitating droughts, really debilitating droughts, and that's when we started dropping all our numbers. So that's where I'm coming from a little bit. I don't like getting caught out with too much capital stock.
Experience.
Yeah. I had to twist his arm pretty hard to get back into breeding ewes, and the Wiltshire was the way that I figured out we could do it, because he didn't want to get back into breeding, because a lot of work with all the wool and the dagging and all that other stuff. But with the Wiltshires, it's literally just put the ram out. They just range about on the hills. They're quite good in the drought. It took about 3 years of just subtle suggestions and sort of saying, look at these, and he didn't really want to know about it. He said, oh, yeah, whatever.
Well, I was a wool man, don't forget. When I first got home, wool was still a big check part of the thing, and I did a wool classing diploma things, and I did all the wool classing. We loved shearing. Shearing was the big moment of the year when we brought everything home, and it was a great time of year. And it was a big check. But now we've got to the stage where, in fact, last time we shore, 1,000 lambs,
$3 a head,
$5, because it's $5 a share them, and we got a dollar for the wool. So, but I've been
small scale. You imagine on a large scale what that's feeling.
So it is
like
hard for people to change, you know, especially older people. But I'm right behind Tom. I mean, I think they're marvellously chic now.
They do drive you a little bit crazy with the mustering sometimes, don't they?
Yeah, but they're not good at gates. They, for some unknown reason, they won't go through gates. They get to a gate and they just mill around. They just won't lead through gates.
They don't break.
Father and son have been working Clifton together for at least 10 years now. The 800-hectare farm was once part of a much bigger property, including Cape Kidnappers, and it's been in the family since 1859.
Hi.
Down below the yards,
hello.
Diversification, hi. That's already proving its worth. Tom and his wife, Lucia, operate two luxury tents, glamping for tourists.
We're just packing everything up now for the 6 weeks that we closed, and we've got lots of maintenance to do, paint the whole thing and put a new tent in at the other one.
It's been the busiest we've ever had it the last season because of COVID. Afterwards, people wanted to get out and about and they were restricted to New Zealand travel. So, yeah, we've had one of the best springs and autumn sort of, and early winter. Summer's always pretty good, but those shoulder seasons have been really good this year.
It's just really private and hopefully relaxing and hopefully luxurious. Yeah.
Sleeping in the wild.
Yeah,
kind of thing,
yeah.
But the luxury
but
style.
But with the comfort and luxury of a five-star
I hear
hotel.
You even iron the sheets on.
Oh, yes. Yeah. But I used to work at a five-star lodge in Taupō and they had glamping there. Quite different to ours, but it was definitely a little seed that was planted when we came here. And then we saw the tents and we thought, oh, let's buy a tent, see what happens.
Angus says the spots where the safari tents are pitched were pretty much wasteland before.
And now they've become, these two sites have become the most valuable sites on the farm. Yeah, and they've never been used.
Because they don't impact the farming operation because they're at the front. So we've got our wool shed behind us, so the stock don't have to travel through and the glampers don't have to travel through, you know, the hub of the farm. They get the experience of driving sort of half a kilometre up the river through all that beautiful scenery to get here, but they're not actually having to get out, open lots of gates and squelch around in the mud on the farm tracks. So it sort of works really well like that, keeping it separate.
The only problem we have is weaning time with the calf weaning because we have all the cattle up at the yards here.
It's
we
only for a night.
Overnight, a couple of nights, and they make a hell of a noise mooing. And I think we've had a complaint.
That was because we had a breakout. One year, and the calves were all down here on the fence.
That's
the
right,
cows.
They came right, around, right outside the tent.
But when they're kept at the back, that's fine. Cause
they're making a hell of a noise.
Not much sleep had that night.
No, not too good.
Yeah.
But did you think, oh, what a crazy idea?
No.
You never did.
No, well, I'm onto all new ideas because we built the cafe in 1999. We built a big cafe down at Clifton there. So I'm always into entrepreneurial type schemes. And I think Tom and Lucia, just following on from that really, they saw an opportunity and saw how well we've done with the cafe, which we lease out now. And I think they just wanted to carry on that sort of tourism side of things, which you see we're not reliant on overseas tourists here. It's all, as Lucia said, it's all Kiwis, which is marvellous. And there's a lot of young couples getting away from their kids. No children allowed here, is it, Tom? Is that right? Which is quite good. It means the couples have to come in and get away from their kids, and they love that.
Tom used to do shearing shows in Japan, and back home, entertain tourists off cruise ships with dog shows and shearing in the old wool shed. But that all came to a grinding halt with COVID. But he's positive about the future.
Like Dad's always said, it's tourism. That's where we'll make the extra dollars. There's so many opportunities. My wife's now... She's been looking at sort of mountain biking. She's getting into mountain biking in a big way. Took some friends around the farm yesterday and they were just all exclaiming at the beauty and what a fun place it was to come. So there's so many different things. We don't even know what's going to come up in the coming years, but we are confident there'll always be new things that we can do here. We're so close to town, so close to Napier and Hastings and Havelock, you know, and so I think we're just in the very lucky spot and it's just going to build from here.
While we've been checking out the tents, the ag students have been moving some of the cattle.
You know the paddock you guys made, the little paddock, last year?
Yep.
You know, with the electric fence where you and I put that gateway in?
Yep.
So we're putting them into there and into the hermit, which is the paddock.
Just put them in there, don't put them through, just put them into that paddock and wait for
And just shut them in there.
We'll be behind you.
I head off with Angus, zooming up and down the steep tracks, Chuck, his dog, alongside.
So all these gorges are full of native trees and a lot of Manuka Kanaka, which over the years we've let come away. When I was young, of course, getting rid of scrub was the big thing.
Yes.
And you had all farmers, where every little bit of land was cleared. But now, since I've been farming, we've just let it go. We've let it regenerate, and it's marvellous, really, because it's good for shade and it's good for the whole.
We've come to a ridge overlooking the Maraitotara River, which borders the property. With the help of grants, a lot of tree planting's being done here.
I've chosen to plant a lot of oak trees, you can see. We've also, like Dad's saying, there's your native bush is just coming away on its own. We've got titoki and kanuka, kōwhai sort of regenerating in the gullies. So I just thought a bit of diversity with some of these other types of trees, redwoods.
And why did you choose this particular block for the planting?
So it starts just down here and it goes for about 4 kilometres up the river and around all the gorges that lead into the river. And it was a problem with mustering. You can see that every time we brought stock home, they'd take off down. They were getting across into the neighbours. And so it was sort of a double thing, obviously preserving the river and also makes it easier for stock movement.
This particular one was because of this big slip.
There's a big slip. That's why we've got quite a large area fenced off. And then if you look over the other side there, you can see that face, that cliff face up the end. That slumped and the whole paddock slipped down into the river and blocked the river. None of these trees have been watered. They've just been
left on their
sprayed,
own.
Planted, and left.
There's been 2 drought years in a yes. row. How have you managed?
Well, we've been lucky because we haven't had that big breeding ewe flock, which we're getting into now. Because we've been finishing lambs, they're all gone by the end of September. And so the farm's just been let go in the spring, and we've had good springs the last few years. And we grow long, rank grass, a lot of clover.
We've got cattle.
So the cattle have got this smorgasbord over the summer to tidy up and grow fat. And we haven't had that problem of worrying about a ewe flock in you know, February, March, April, May, June, right through winter, like a lot of people have had.
We're into this regenerative type of farming where all the clover comes away and seeds down over the summer. So it's all flowering. The farm looks fantastic in the summer because it flowers, the clover, seeds down, and then we come in and clean it up, and you can see how clean the cows do. Great job. And then it's great for lambs.
And what about fertilisers?
Don't use much. We haven't used fertiliser out of here for what?
10 years out on the hills?
We don't need to. The clover's doing its job, really.
With all the new water regulations coming in, have you got a lot of fencing to do on the farm?
Yeah, we're doing new stuff every year. So we've done this 4 kilometres here. We've done another 2.5 of another part of the gorge, and we're talking about the next stage of that, which is about 3 kilometres on one side.
The Gordons have put another 50 hectares of difficult land like this into pine trees for carbon farming. And there are crops on the easier flats on the coast down below.
With the carbon credits, I mean, how does that contribute financially to the farm?
Huge. It's going to contribute hugely. For example, that paddock out there is it's 50 hectares of very bluffy country, which we lose a lot of stock on, and I think, you know, we'd be bloody lucky to make $300-$400 a hectare a year. Well, we could be looking at getting up to $2,000 a hectare a year out of carbon credits. So it doesn't make sense. It's why everyone's running after putting their farms into carbon credits, into trees, because it's just ludicrous. It's a false thing, really, to be paid for just planting something that's not doing anything.
You think it's crazy the money they pay you for this?
Of course it is. It's ridiculous money that the people who buy the carbon credits are people who are still polluting. They can just go on doing what they want by buying our credits. It's a silly system. But anyway, it's the system, and that's what we go along with. We're not going to argue about it because it's the system.
Angus says the farm's come a long way since even his father's day.
My father liked to have the place looking like a golf course by the end of summer, so that every blade of grass was chewed out, then you waited for the rain to come. And that was the theory, and you waited for the rain to come and you poured the fertiliser on, and then if the rain didn't come, you were buggered. And it was a very stressful way of farming, and it was the way everyone farmed. Nothing unusual about that. That was how we all farmed. In fact, in the 70s, Muldoon thought the whole way to farm was have numbers, so he put in the subsidies where you got paid for the amount of stock you had on your farm. He thought it was a numbers game. So when I came back to New Zealand in 1976 from overseas, New Zealand had 70 million sheep. was ridiculous. We had 70 million sheep and they were all little sheep and they were all struggling for, you know, because you were being paid for every sheep you owned. The Labour government came in and they just totally just whacked everything. They just, all the subsidies went, the wool subsidies went, and we were left on our own. And it was a pretty desperate sort of time, really, for everyone. A lot of farmers got out of it. They got into selling off land for lifestyle blocks, blah, blah, blah. But we were saved because I got involved with John Bostock growing early squash. We were pioneers, actually, and it was a great success. And we did that for 15 years on those flats and were able to then commit to building the cafe. The cafe was a raging success because we're quite close to town. But it was hard. I mean, a farmer becoming a restaurateur and Diana and I, it was a terrible learning experience, really. And we had no systems, and people just came, flooded in. They'd been watching us build it, and they came flooding in. And the great thing was they were very forgiving because we were making a mess of things. We were floundering. We couldn't, you know, and we went through a whole lot of different chefs. And until we got these friends of ours who were flatting, who were ex-restaurateurs, they were so good. But it was very stressful, and I was running the farm at the same time. And
you were thinking, why on earth did I do this?
What have I done? And Diana, my wife, said, I'm like a tooth you. I enjoyed the had the lamb, and then I ran away from it. She said it was like running away. All I wanted to do was run back onto the farm and get away from it all. By then, wool, which had been the main check of the farm for 130 years, suddenly became the fourth check on the farm, and it's now not even a check. We pay the checks now. Trying to always plan and see what's coming next. Where go, Chuck?
We're up on one of the higher points of the farm, Round Hill.
Come on, Chuck, come on. He's only a young dog. He said, ah, Chuck, get up here, Chuck. Get up here, Chuck. Where to go, Chuck? Get up here, Chuck. Get up here, Chuck. He's a young dog and he's as keen as mustard now. He's starting to get a bit of a know-all. Chuck, come here. Get up here. Turning into a little bit of a know-all. Get up here, Chuck. He's got a magnificent bark on him, though. Look at that. Fourth time up the hill. Come on, get up here. Get up. Get up. Up. That's better. He is such a know.
With Chuck back on board, Angus recounts how his ancestor, James Gillespie Gordon, a jute merchant in India, arrived with a prefab house on board his schooner back in the 1800s. The house, complete with intricately carved Indian furniture, was floated ashore, and army mules from India dragged it and JG's bath up the beach. The house made of teak subsequently burnt down, but a new one was built in the same spot on the coast, way down below where we are on Round Hill.
My grandfather planted these trees here many years ago, so this hill here can be seen from all around Hawke's Bay. It's called Round Hill, and so it's used as a marker point for out at the sea a lot when the boat's coming in. We spread my father's ashes out here because he wanted to be up here so he can keep an eye on everything. So I have to, when the thistles get carried away some years, I have to come up and apologise to him a bit about it because he hated thistles. But we're looking south down there towards Waimarama, and then over there. If you
look, we're down by the sea now, in the homestead. Angus grew up here, one of six children.
This is all the Indian furniture that was saved. Saved from the fire in 1898, but when all the shearers were here, just took it out.
From here, Angus has written several books, a family history and one about the area's historic wool sheds. The home features in his latest book, Historic Homesteads of Hawke's Bay.
I think that was the inspiration, yes, having grown up on one of these sort of places, and I love all the other places, nosing around. I'm a nosy sort of person. Loved nosing around all the other old places around Hawke's Bay, and we had a lot of good architects at Hawke's Bay because there was quite a lot of money around in those days. It was all based on the wool on the sheep's back in those days. Yeah, so it's just that romance of it all the shearing and the old growing up in an old house and the fun of it all and the just, yeah.
You would have had some fun in this place.
We did have some great fun in this place, and we had a lot of good parties over the years.
Angus's passion, though, is poetry, inspired by the surrounding landscape. And with Tom on the farm, he hopes to spend a lot more time writing in the years to come.
Won an award, this poem, called Summing Up the Mood. Summing up the mood of all things past and gone, I'd say the sea, in all its weather-beaten ways, is closest to the fallen leaf and sound.
Angus Gordon on the veranda of Clifton in Hawke's Bay. His book, Historic Homesteads of Hawke's Bay, is published by Mary Egan Publishing.
Well, that's it for this week. Now, our webpage has photos and more stories, and remember, you can subscribe to our podcast there too.
Email us with your feedback or stories at country@rnz.co.nz or send a text to 2101. Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Stay warm. Mā te wā.
Bye now.